Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men or bisexual men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this broadcast, you can either call them in at area code 646-716-4893, or if you're feeling radio shy, you can always email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. Tonight I am really excited because I have a wonderful friend who is willing to return here on a semi-regular basis, which I always appreciate so much. She takes out the time to join us to really help our women in their recovery process. And many of you have heard her before. Her name is Mary Ann Glynn. She's a therapist from New Jersey who really specializes in helping women with post-traumatic stress, coming out of bad relationships, and also addictions. So she's a woman who can really helps so many people and does help so many people. So welcome back, Mary Ann. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's good to be here again.
And I really had the wonderful pleasure of finally getting to meet you in person a few months ago.
I know, and in the flesh.
I know. I'm so happy to meet you, and hopefully we'll be doing that again when a little bit the warmer weather is here.
Sure.
And you really, you know, made some very significant contributions to women in general. First, I want to talk a little bit about your app, because I always talk to people about your app because so many people need it. And I know that a lot of our listeners have asked me more about it, and some of them have gotten the app and love it. So Let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, this came out of the work that you do with post-traumatic stress. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Actually, I developed the app because it seemed to be the missing link of everything I learned about trauma, and I've been studying it, you know, more intensely in the last few years, even though I've always, from the beginning of my practice, realized that trauma directs so much of our behaviors, and especially if it's severe trauma. So I made it my business to learn some techniques that actually addressed trauma and got to it, because just talking about, you know, just talking about it, you know, talk therapy is not really, you can talk about it forever and never really heal from it because it's stored in the brain in particular ways. And there are only particular ways you can really get to it, to work at it. So I, you know, I've been studying those things and using them over many years. And then some of the things that I learned in the past few years about, you know, now that they can do brain scans and they understand more about how the brain works, they can see how the brain, you know, connects to different things. They discover this thing called neuroplasticity, which means the opening of new neural pathways in the brain. And when you can open new neural pathways in the brain, then you can create new patterns or recondition it, you know, create new behaviors. So basically, I developed the app on that concept and what they found, the things that they have found that can create and open new neural pathways in the brain. And it's actually what it's kind of like focused attention or mindfulness, like mindful inner tracking. And that's what my app does. It kind of helps you to connect to emotional triggers, whether it's emotional flashbacks from post-traumatic stress, addiction triggers, relationship triggers, moods and different things that just occur during the day out of nowhere. And you go, what was that? You know, you're going along in your day and everything is fine. And then suddenly you're in kind of a bad mood or feel bad about yourself. Has that ever happened to you?
Well, it absolutely
has. You know what I'm talking about?
But here's the one thing I wanted, maybe you could give a little explanation for. You know, I hear this terminology being used more and more with trauma and post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the past, I think it was something that was kind of confined more to people in the service coming home from war.
Right,
I know
shell
that,
shock.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that now I've heard this term more and more, you know, with the women who work, you know, as part of our network. And that it's being recognized more and more as something that's beyond being shell-shocked out of war. And I think that
mm-hmm.
women are somewhat hesitant to say that. You know, they tell me all the time they feel guilty saying that this is post-traumatic shock. They think that's reserved for people who go through a battle. But there's all kinds
of
battles that people go through, right?
Right. And there's different kinds of trauma. You know, there's trauma with a big T. That would be something like going to a war. Or being raped,
mm-hmm.
Or being sexually abused as a child, or beaten, or those kinds of things, or being in a bad
mm-hmm.
car accident, or 9/11. You know, that would be trauma with a big T, like a big event. And
mm-hmm.
of course, depending on how old you are when those things happen, you know, the younger you are, the more deeply it's going to affect you and be kind of burned into your brain. But when you're older, those things, and of course it depends on the extent, if you're in a war and you're there for years and you're watching people die and you're threatened 24/7, it's going to be pretty severe. But then there's trauma with a small T, and everyone has some of this. And of course this is all in varying degrees. But for instance, if you are in a relationship, like many of the women who listen to your show are in, and on a daily basis, they're feeling distancing from their partner, right? It starts to, you know, kind of that. It starts to create a sense of uneasiness and unsafety, and then that can trigger earlier things in your life into it. Or if the person is outright abusive in the relationship, that can also trigger earlier childhood victimization, if there is any. But even if not, just like ongoing verbal abuse, distancing, finding out
mm-hmm.
that the person you're with is leading a double life, or, you know, those kinds, that's hugely shocking. And it creates a strong threat. It's traumatic shock. It's like a threat to our a sense of who we are. It's a psychological threat rather than a physical threat, but a very devastating one nonetheless. So then you do have the symptoms of post-traumatic stress after that. It can take years to recover from. And also, even
the
if,
way
as
I was
a child,
mm-hmm.
another example is like if you're a child, and a lot of people
mm-hmm.
say, well, I had a fine child, so nothing bad happened to me. My parents are pretty good. They love me. But but let's say in your childhood you were constantly corrected or punished a lot or criticized a lot or didn't get enough affirmation. Well, those things can create, you know, lack of confidence and poor self-esteem. But let's say you also, like, heard your parents yelling at each other a lot. For a child, that can be pretty distressing.
Mm-hmm.
And those are like the little traumas that we kind of carry with us that also come into adulthood and direct a lot of what the way we react to things.
I think that a lot of our women really suffer with this because of the fact that they do have marriages where there is a lot of emotional abuse. I would say
mm-hmm.
sexual abuse, because sexual neglect
mm.
is sexual abuse in its own way.
Also,
the whole trust issues.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Pardon me?
No, I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead. I was going to say, sexual deceit is all feels like sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm. And also the fact that you find out that your husband is cheating on you, and
mm-hmm.
that not only cheating on you, but it's with a man. So that's
mm-hmm.
even more traumatizing, because then you start to feel, well, where did I fail as a woman?
Mm.
And unfortunately, many of our women have husbands who will just keep pushing that aspect of it, that thanks to you, this is how I am, because they can't be honest with anyone and they don't want to take any responsibility.
Right.
Some of these men become physically abusive because they're very frustrated living a life that's not theirs to live, but they
mm-hmm.
don't know how to get out. They feel trapped because they can't be
yeah.
honest. So a lot of our women really do suffer from trauma. And some long-term marriages where people are mistreated for so many years, it really hurts me badly when I find a woman who's married for 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 years who's
mm-hmm.
had no love, no affection. Yes,
yeah.
because he just
yeah.
couldn't be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he withheld that information, and she can't ever figure out what she's doing wrong. And, you know, I always say that straight wives are the best wives because they're trying harder and harder to make something work that will never work, and they don't know why it's not working. So they
right,
internalize
blaming
it and
themselves.
They feel they're blaming
right.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then their husbands chip in, you know, and they also
oh,
blame
and they're,
them too.
They're glad. Yeah, they're glad to let them take the responsibility, sure.
Yeah, sure. Let's pass it on to you. And without
right.
telling them the real reasons, because they are a woman. So many of
yeah.
our women are really wounded, and that's why I think this, you know, they go for therapy, and they go into, and this is like an ideal tool if you are with a therapist, right?
Oh, back to the app, okay. yeah, well, actually, even if you're with a therapist or not with a therapist,
mm-hmm.
it's a good tool because, okay, you can go to a therapist, and this is really why I did it, I decided to make it in the first place. You can go to a therapist once a week, right? Once or once every
mm-hmm.
2 weeks, whatever a person does. That's an hour out of your life. Now, the rest of the time, it's going to be, because life is so busy, it's going to be a little tough to try to be self-aware and mindful and all those things you're supposed to do in order to change and have and be aware of what's going on inside and create new habits and new resources, right? So
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, this is kind of a missing link, that if a person had a tool that they could refer to every day, it could keep them focused, which is one of the things that creates neuroplasticity. It can keep them, and it guides you through, you know, mindful connection, how to find resources to then deal with whatever reaction you're having and track it. And that also is part of opening new neural pathways. So, you know, all of those things together are going to help a person change and heal a lot faster than just coming into therapy once a week, you know? And that's the
mm-hmm.
whole point, really.
And also, I think you mentioned that you can really discuss these issues with your therapist. Let's say if you are going for therapy and you want to keep notes of what's happened to you in that week that created this reaction, then you have it right there, right?
Yeah, it's all documented in the app, and you can even email the information to your therapist during the week. You can, you know, go through the different screens and check off things and add, fill in, you know, blanks that are there, and you can send that information to your therapist during the week, so which is helps you to be accountable, is supportive, keeps you on track, and can keep you and the therapist focused on the goals.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't have a therapist, it still helps you, right?
Yeah, you don't need a therapist to use it.
It'll help you with refocusing where your thoughts are going.
It's all
and try to put you back on track, right?
Yeah. Well, it can keep you focused because it's right there in your hand. And if you have one of these reactions during the day, let's say you have a fight with your significant other, right? And you just feel frustrated and maybe you're feeling, you know, bad with it. And that's one of those situations usually that is caused by something that's subconscious that you're not that aware of. So let me give you an example. Let's say, you know, you have a – and usually couples fight over the same thing a lot. You know, it's kind of the same theme that comes up. Like, let's see, what's an example? You never pick your clothes up off the floor, okay? Which seems like a small thing, a stupid thing, but it's something that people fight over, okay? But really the underlying issue is that – you know, a person might feel like they're not heard or not significant or don't matter, okay? Now, those things come from way back in us. Those things, you know, if we're having reactions like that to clothes on the floor, that's coming from us. That's coming from some kind of conditioning and belief that is in us since childhood, most likely. So the app would help you to kind of get in touch with that. What's going on in your emotion? What's going on in your thoughts? What do you feel in your body right now? What does that remind you of? And it can get you in touch with the underlying issue. And then you can go back to your spouse, for instance, or your partner, and share what you're really feeling, which is a much more powerful thing than just fighting over something and having a power struggle over it ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would really be helpful, I think, for a lot of people, because a lot of the issues that come up with our women is that, you know, they were traumatized through their marriages, and many of them don't go through the steps necessary to make positive changes before they meet their next predator that comes into their life. Right. Well, I always say, if you're not strong, there's some predator out there waiting for you. And it's no accident that he finds the women that we have, because our women are very vulnerable. They're very giving. They're very caring. And, you know,
and they've been
traumatized
already.
They've already been traumatized, and people know that. You know, I tell women, it's not an accident that your gay husband picked you to be the wife. You know, they're looking for women who have had problems. They're looking for women who are understanding, who are fixer-uppers. You know, a lot of times we're the women who always try to fix everything. And if it doesn't
work,
take
too much responsibility.
Well, exactly.
Right.
I mean, there's a certain kind of woman, right? I'm sure you see it in plenty of the relationships that you work with, right?
Yeah, I think they groom. I mean, you're what you're talking about. They're going to groom the woman. They're going to see, you know, how does she respond when I don't take any responsibility and blame her, for instance. Oh, she takes the blame. Oh, good one, you know. How is she going to respond when I tell her a lie? Oh, she believed it. Okay, you know, put another dash on the scoreboard.
Exactly.
You know,
and I think
how loyal is she? How much is she willing to take it? Yeah.
And there's a lot of men who are like this, because there are some wonderful, wonderful men, but there are a lot of men who aren't wonderful. And I think they're very manipulative and looking for women like this. And they know, you know, how to smell them out, how to sniff them out, because, you know, we must have a sign on our head that says S, like for sucker or something. But, you know, I've been thinking, am I wearing an S? But, you know, it's a matter that they can see vulnerable women who've gone through bad relationships who look hurt. You can look hurt when you're just walking through life. And this is who they look for, because they know that they can get away with stuff. And I tell women, like, the best example to me is when you look at domestic violence. I don't believe that there's any woman who went out on her first date and had the guy beat her in the face You know, that doesn't
no.
happen on your first date or your second
no.
date. This is something
mm-hmm.
that they feel you out. You know, they take their time getting you, you know, involved with them to a point where you're so in love with them. And then they can act how they want to act because they know
right.
that you're going to forgive them, right?
Yeah, because I think after you get attached to them, which, you know, usually can have, of course, from sex and all that oxytocin and just,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting emotionally very close, and I'm sure they have their best behavior on or they're being deliberately manipulative, you know, depending. But once a woman especially, and like probably men do this too, but once a woman decides that this is a good person or that they love, you know, they love this person, like all the red
mm-hmm.
flags go out the window, right? Then they just don't see them anymore or they refuse to see them.
Or, you know, even I think sometimes they see them because what I thought was interesting, I know that you work pretty closely with Donna Anderson, you know, because I read your
mm-hmm.
articles in her, you know, newsletter. Donna
mm-hmm.
had written an article that I thought was really fascinating that I really brought up to my women I bring it up from, you know, often, that when I read that she wrote this article that there was, you know, when she took a survey of people who go with sociopaths, that like
mm-hmm.
72% of them knew ahead of time before they said their final I do's that something was wrong to tell them that, say, I don't,
yeah.
but they didn't. And
yeah.
that to me was an
yeah.
amazing number, but I'm not surprised by it. I mean, I
me
think
either.
That many of us have those red flags, but we're just ignoring them or we're hoping, well, we'll just get better, right?
Right, because it's like you said, they're already attached to this person. They're planning to be with this person for the rest of their life, and they're thinking the best about this person. So if a red flag comes up, they might kind of note it, but they'll explain it away.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They know it's there, but they're not really paying attention to it or they're pushing it away. After the fact, they go back and say, oh, wow, he came right out and told me that he was a bad person, or he told me he might be gay, you know, or he told me that, you know, he has a bad temper. But I just thought it would go away. We'd be married. Everything will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, I think it's like a tiny, at that point, it's a tiny voice that you're just not really paying attention to.
Exactly. And, you know, I have to wonder about that sometimes also, that do you think it's mostly women who have low self-esteem that do this?
No, not necessarily. Could be. Which situation are you talking about? Being with
about
a gay
marrying
man?
Somebody when you have it doesn't have to be a gay man, but people who have, you know, go into destructive relationships knowing there's something wrong ahead of time.
Well, I think there might be some vulnerability there. It doesn't necessarily have to be low self-esteem. Other vulnerabilities would include something like getting older. Being alone and being afraid, you know, not liking to be alone, you know, worried that you won't find somebody or having been through a divorce or a death, for instance. And naivety is a big one. Naivety
mm-hmm.
is a big one. So, yeah, I think there's a vulnerability, but it's not always self-esteem. I think you can be a perfectly fine person. But what happens, but what's interesting is that even if you had some difficulties when you were younger that you overcame in your
mm-hmm.
childhood or other, in your even a divorce or different things that you may have, when you end up with somebody who is destructive or abusive, there's only one way that they know how to be in a relationship, and that's in a position of power and
mm-hmm.
control. Or, you know, they only know how to be in that role. So you're going to be victimized. Like, you know, you're going to be, you know, victimized by the fact that they're going to be abusive or dismissive or, you know, whatever it is, they're manipulative. So then what do you do? You know, what do we do when we're being victimized? Well, no one responds very well to that. Usually it's shocking. You know, it's shocking and it's like horrifying. So what do? You kind of just dissociate or freeze over to get through it. You know what I mean? You just kind of, you know what I mean by dissociate? It's almost like you take
your
mind
away. Yeah, so you
kind
of, right, exactly.
Away. And if you've been victimized in childhood and learn to dissociate in childhood, then it becomes all the more automatic to you in the bad relationship.
Right, you learn
how
to zoom
out. But
nothing
works in a relationship like that, right? Nothing works. Like if you're being yelled at on a, you know, if you're being verbally abused, if you fight back, does that help? Does it, if you withdraw, does that, nothing really works, you know? If you try to reason with the person, you try to be honest, nothing really works because that person has an agenda to stay in control, to keep you in the dark or whatever it is.
And here's the interesting thing. I think that, like you were saying, you may have had traumas in your life, but as you get older, you overcome a lot of them. And
mm-hmm.
I certainly know that in my life, which is certainly has been really screwed up when I was younger. But as I got older, I think I was moving on a really positive track. And when I met my ex-husband, you know, my ex-gay husband, it was a matter that he was also extremely controlling, kind of like on a borderline personality kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, he had to have his way or scream and yell. And I was a really strong woman when I met him. I mean, I had a really strong kind of job. I'd really put my life together. I was looking good.
Mm-hmm.
I was over, you know, so many issues in my life, and I was at my best point ever. And yet when I married someone who had those destructive qualities, he was able to beat me down. It didn't take long because,
yeah.
You know, he knew how to push the buttons that brought back all those insecurities and fears. He
uh-huh.
knew just how far to push when he wanted me to give in. And also, I don't like living in conflict, so a lot of times it was just easier to give in. So
mm-hmm.
I used to say, you know, often that he would, you know, as I've said it before, you know, he would shout me down to shut me up because
I'm
that
sure
way
that,
he
mm-hmm.
could win. And that's what it used to be. I would give in, I would shut up, and I would just
mm-hmm.
say, okay. And I started losing who I was as a person. And that was all within a relatively short time. And I was feeling really good when I went into this marriage about me.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean.
But it didn't take long. A couple of years later, I didn't even know who I was anymore because I wasn't me anymore.
Exactly.
So that's
with
somebody who went in strong.
One of the, and I'm sure that's exactly. He could, early on, he could tell that about you. That, you know, he'd be able to get away with that, and you would still be a compassionate, loyal partner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that same thing happened to me, too. I was a very, you know, I had been through much therapy in my life, feeling very wonderful with, you know, so many things around me. There was maybe a vulnerability to me, like having gone through the death of a husband, getting older, you know, but my biggest vulnerability was being naive, not knowing that people like this existed, you know, that people would actually manipulate you into marrying them, which ends up being a cover for a double
mm-hmm.
life or whatever. So, you know, that was the biggest vulnerability. And it tore me down too. I couldn't believe it. It was the weirdest thing because my first marriage was a good marriage. It was a good man. We had,
mm-hmm.
We both had enough honesty to be able to talk through things. We went to therapy together. We did all kinds of marriage enhancement kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
you know, keep getting emotionally closer and healing, blah, blah, blah. So then when I ended up with this person, I was flabbergasted all the time. Like, what's going on? I don't understand. I'm trying to do all the things I already know that work. You know, in
mm-hmm.
communicating and being, you know, taking responsibility, being humble and caring. You know, everything I could think of is racking my brains. What's wrong here? Nothing is working. You know, nothing is working. It was like, and it was. You're right. Just destroys you little by little. It just takes.
You lose
now, did
yourself.
You suspect that when you got married to him?
No. I tell you, though, in the back of my mind, there was something like eating deep in my mind that I wasn't really paying attention to or else I didn't understand. There was something eating about, like, I had never really seen him share very honestly that I could tell. You know, not that he couldn't be real, but I wondered deep down if there was an ability to do that for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But it never came clear till a couple of years later, maybe.
I think the problem is, like, when we're younger, we always have this optimistic hopefulness that no matter, even if there's some problems, they always say it takes time to work it out till you get to know each other, you know, give it a chance, you know you love him. And so he has some weaknesses, whatever it is, but with your help and your strength, that will straighten itself out. And I think that as women, you know, who are helping, caring, loving, vulnerable women, this is what happens to us. I mean, even if we have some red flag saying that, you know, there's something off here, we always think if we love them enough, it will go away. If we show them this unconditional love that we trust them and we love them and we'll support them, and if he has problems, we'll help him fix them. And I think this is really typical of the women who, at least I know, that I'm involved with. They're fixer-uppers.
Yeah, yep.
And we don't realize what the obstacles are because these guys just don't get fixed.
You know,
they're just too broken and you can't fix them. And then they knock you down. So, you know, I always say that you can't fix a broken man, but he can break you.
Oh, that's a good saying. Yeah.
That's my mantra.
what you were saying in is hypothetically true. Like in a regular relationship, right? Those things do happen. You know, compassion for each other and taking responsibility, working through things makes the bond stronger, helps us to each flex and change a little bit so that we can adjust to each, you know, in a healthy marriage, those things actually do happen. You know, your compassion and your, you know, caretaking kind of persona can be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, taking
it can be, but you have to
it
have
can
a,
be.
You have to have a partner who is the same way. Then it can be a good thing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, in life, there are takers and there are givers, and I know that the givers need someone to give with, and the takers need someone to take from. But if you don't have balance, it can really, you know, really destroy that, right?
Right. Exactly. My father used to say that to me all the time when I was used to say. In this life, there are givers and there are takers.
Mm-hmm.
Say that phrase to me all the time. I think
you
know
a lot
more what that meant.
But
yeah.
It's not bad, but they have to, you know, it has to be some kind of balance there. Otherwise, you're giving, and the other person just keeps taking, and you have no quality of life.
No,
I had a letter come in from someone who's listening to our show right now. She's in Idaho.
Uh-huh.
And her name is Nancy, and she says, can you please ask Marianne about codependency and if that has to do with addiction?
Hi, Nancy. Codependency, I'm not sure what she's asking exactly. Codependent people become more addicted?
Well, I think she means, like, when you're involved with someone, you can't let go. Is codependency like an addiction?
Well, actually, yes, it is. It's like an addiction. I mean, you know, addiction technically is something that, you know, is a substance, but codependency is it's more like a compulsion, but it's got the same kind of thing. It takes us, like an addiction, it takes us away from our own pain, okay? We focus on somebody else instead of our own issues, so we avoid, you know, whatever it is that is difficult for us. So, yes, in that way, you can call it an addiction. Sure.
I think this came out of a discussion some of us were having, you know, in our support group about some women who can't let go of their marriages No, even though they know mm-hmm. they're destructive, even though they know there's cheating going on, and yet they keep saying, I love my husband, I love my husband, I know that it's wrong. You know, what he's doing to me is wrong, but I don't know how to stop loving him. So
well,
maybe
that might
I think
be more
she might
about,
have been referring.
Let's see. Well, that might be more about what you, a person experiences in letting go of the attachment. You know, because especially codependent people attach, it's like over-attach. You get almost, you know, you become, you're so focused on the other person that without that person, you're probably going to experience a much greater loss than someone who has a healthy attachment. So the hard part would be letting go of that person, because in that space or in that separation, you're going to feel your own stuff that you've been avoiding all this time, and you're just going to feel the loss, and there might be a sense of abandonment in there. So it's real, not being able to let go is avoiding having to feel those feelings that you feel when you do let go. You just keep going back to avoid having to go through that.
And I think part makes of the sense. Problem is that these men don't want to let go. You know, they want you to stay.
Well, they don't make it easy.
You're doing, no, right. They're doing all the work. You're doing all the work for them. You're their mm-hmm. cover that, you know, they have a wife and children, so it must be okay. Mm-hmm. And they're used to you doing for them all the time, so they're not letting go so fast. And then the women keep getting dragged back because they're thinking, well, I know with me, I know I was so beaten down, I didn't think I really could do much. You know, when you live with someone who keeps telling you you're worthless, you don't,
that's
you know,
true too.
You can't do anything right, you know, you don't clean mm-hmm. good, you don't take care of the children right, you don't look right. You know, it's only a matter of time till all these messages do beat you down when you do, you know, kind of, I can't make it on my own.
Well, that is true, and that's part of the whole control process, isn't it? To keep
mm-hmm.
you there.
It definitely
mm-hmm.
is. You know, I wanted to talk to you tonight. Also, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, we were going to talk a little bit tonight about addiction. This was a good lead-in for it, since, you know, mm-hmm. Nancy had asked about it. And I know that you work a lot with addiction, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And mm-hmm. there's all kinds of addictions that are out there. We think of addiction many times as, you know, having to do with drugs, alcohol, smoking, eating. But there's also people who have sexual addictions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times women will come to me and they think their husbands are gay because they're having sex with men. But they're also
mm-hmm.
very freely having sex with women. And
mm-hmm.
when I say they're having a lot of sex in general, it's not like just an attraction. It's an addictive kind of sex. And
mm-hmm.
they would have sex with anything. We've had women on in our support group that I've met whose husbands had sex with dogs and cats.
Yeah.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
I know it's not normal, but the point is that this is an addictive kind of thing versus a gay thing, I think. That's the only way I know how to explain it.
Yeah,
it doesn't make it
right,
any better.
In other words, right, that's different than just, yeah.
Right,
and,
we'll have sex with anything, anyone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think sexual addiction, well, I don't think it, it's definitely on the rise with the internet. It has been on the rise for years with the internet because
mm-hmm.
there's so much pornography on the internet. But sexual addiction usually has something to do with a person having some sort of abuse, not always. Like, I've heard a lot of men say this, that either they were abused at an early age sexually or they were seduced at a too young age by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And with women with sexual addictions and promiscuity most often have sexual abuse when they're young. And there is something about, you know, there seems to be kind of a hypersexuality to people like this. Now, that could be something that's in their brain or biology, but it's kind of what nature versus nurture thing, or was it just some connection they made at some point in their life that having sex made them feel powerful and in control and very high and stimulated?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because sex is a very powerful
drug in the body, just like if you took heroin or cocaine, the body makes this powerful, like, whoa, you know, connection to the feeling that is produced by the drug and how it makes you feel, so that afterwards you want it again. Well, sex is a pretty powerful drug, too.
Well, I know, for instance, I've met people, including me. I had a previous marriage to a man who had obsessive compulsive behavior, and
mm-hmm.
it manifested sexually as well. And
mm-hmm.
at first, you think that, wow, this guy's really into me because he wants me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it's really flattering, like for the first couple of weeks. But then after
yeah.
that, it becomes not very flattering because it's a matter that it's not making love with somebody. It's just an action.
Mm-hmm.
And this action, I've spoken to a number of women who have been in this situation. I mean, you can have intercourse for 30, 40, 50, you know, a minute, like almost an hour. But that's all. And I mean, that's not a normal kind of an intercourse when you can do that 2-3 times a day.
No.
And matter that this is part of obsessive compulsive behavior. This is another form of the sexual addiction. But I, like I say, it's not a normal kind of sex. And
no, well,
I
it's
just
sexual
don't...
addiction. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Almost cut you
I'm sorry. You go ahead.
No,
you
finish
go right
what
ahead.
You're saying. Okay.
No, I was going to say that I don't feel that there's really help for people like this because they don't really want to give up these addictions when it comes to sex. Have you had success with this?
I have had a couple of people personally, yeah, in my practice. Supposedly, the rate for getting over a sexual addiction is something like 80%. That I believe is Dr. True. Because it's just like any other addiction, if someone is really motivated to get over it,
mm-hmm.
if something happens in their, you know, something, they have an epiphany or you know, or they have something they're about to lose, strongly motivated, they can overcome it. Certainly it can be overcome, like any other addiction. I think the problem is that a lot of these people you're talking about with sexual addiction, and this is true of a lot of the partners of the client, a lot of clients I work with, you know, who are sociopaths, you know, narcissists,
mm-hmm.
psychopathic kinds of people. Many of them have sex addictions and many partners, and they're serial cheaters. But those people have something wrong in their personality where they will never change. They don't change. They don't want to change. So
mm-hmm.
they're not going to change that. But you could also, but you know, a normal person that doesn't have a personality disorder like that can also have a sex addiction, and those people can change that addiction if they're highly motivated to do so.
Right, and that's the key word, highly
that.
Motivated.
Right.
Yeah, because I think addiction in general, you know, I know that we've talked about it because you were kind enough to read the book I have out about my daughter, about Jennifer, you know, who died from heroin addiction. And it became an impossible task for me to try to really take any kind of hold or control over that because I just was, you know, I just didn't even know which way to turn. You know, it's a certain point, every time you think you're ahead of the game, boom, you're back down. You know, I just didn't know how to fight that enemy called heroin. And
well,
my daughter, when she started taking it, didn't know how to fight it either. It was, you know, too late. And very few people
yeah.
that I know of do recover from heroin addiction. There are a few. I'm not sure what
yeah.
makes the difference between those who do and don't. Maybe it's age. Maybe it's how many times you get knocked down. Maybe
I don't
it's
know,
continued
Bonnie.
Motivation. I don't know either. I don't have the answer.
It's only 10% the rate, you know, the cure rate for heroin. It's 10%. That means that 90% of heroin users die from it or end up in jail.
Right.
You know, they never stop. So, or they die of a death related to it, or but mostly it's overdose. Because it's so powerful, it takes a hold on someone immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And unless something really drastic happens, a person is not likely to. I mean, it's like deep down they might loathe what they're doing, but the draw, the pull to use is so powerful, it just takes them over in no time.
And then they turn into like little criminals and will do virtually anything, you know, whether it's prostitute, steal from their own families, you know. It's heartbreaking, and your book is so profoundly honest. I bought several copies to keep to give to parents because it's such a hell for parents to go through to watch their kids use
and
and put them in rehab and nothing works, and I've seen it over and over.
And I think parents really, just like straight wives, we internalize the blame and the pain. You know, there's a lot of similarities there of the reactions of the people who are going through it. I did a speaking engagement, you know, a couple of weeks ago at one of the hospitals here where there was a support group, and I read to the parents, you know, part of the book from Jennifer Needle in her arm about the blame game that we play, and the same thing with, you know, I had the blame game first when for straight wives when, you know, you're blaming and then you think it's your fault, you know, and you're embarrassed. It has a lot of the same traumas. You know, people with gay husbands don't go around announcing, oh, I have a gay husband. They keep it hidden. And people who have children who are drug addicts also aren't going around saying, oh, guess what? My kid's a drug addict. I mean, this is something that you take responsibility for, whether, and I said that can't be every parent's fault. You have good children. Why did this child turn out, you know, doing things like a drug addict, you know, drugs? So a lot of times, though, parents always feel that it's their failure. And
I say
that's not necessarily the case. There are some loving, wonderful parents who have the same problems. It's part of, I think, a predisposed kind of thing where addiction does run through families, whether it's drugs or alcohol. I think it's same part of the same thing. Am I right on that?
Absolutely. And yeah, you know, parents are tortured by the guilt and shame they feel when they have a child with this problem. But really, what's going on, I mean, you know, plenty of kids, all kids in high school, well, not all, I shouldn't say, at least half kids, you know, with alcohol and marijuana and some experiment with some of the other things, but only 10% of those kids become addicted. And when they researched brain scans, PET scans of these of kids that become addicted versus the normal, what they found is that their brains are different. It's actually biological. Their brains, there are two things. They overreact to stress. In other words, they have a kind of sensitive nervous system that don't know how to regulate, and they have a lack of dopamine receptors. So that immediately puts them in that's depression. You're going to feel depression. You're going to feel anxiety. And most, let me see, what are the statistics? I'm trying to think. Co-occurring disorders, they, you know, people who have both a mental illness and an addiction is like at least 50%. Okay, I mean, it's huge. If you like ADHD, depression, bipolar, anxiety, panic disorder, eating disorders, they're like at least twice as likely to have a drug problem. And then if you have some trauma in your background, and trauma can come from lots of different things. It doesn't have to come from the home. It can come from being made fun of at school, for instance, or having a hard time learning, or sexual abuse or outside the home. You know, there are lots of things that can happen to a person. So those are the things that actually make someone vulnerable to addiction. So you could be a good parent and still have a kid who is going to become addicted because of their biology,
with addiction,
and opportunity too, you know, it's around them.
But I say with addiction, I mean, you can correct me if you think I'm wrong. I think that it really is predisposed, just like I think homosexuality, people don't have a choice with that. You know, they're born a certain way. I feel that with addiction, that's predisposed also. I mean, you have more of a choice than being gay, because gay is who you are. It's not any kind of choice.
Right.
But as far as, you know, drugs or alcohol is concerned, I think you really, I guess my best example would be that, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, and, you know, I'm being honest, you know, went through the whole thing with, you know, as far as marijuana was concerned. But You know, if I would have a half a joint of marijuana, I'd be stoned out and pass out. And I used to say to my daughter, I don't understand this. Why can't you just get high on pot? Why do you have to go put needles in your arm? Like, I never understood why that kind of high wasn't high enough, you know, because I guess maybe because I'm not an addict. You know, I don't understand it. Just like with drinking, you know, they say one drink for somebody who's an alcoholic, you know, it's too much. You can never drink enough.
Some of it might be, I'm thinking what you're talking about, like some kids will actually be created to have a dependence on marijuana. In other words, they become like addicted to it. You know, they use marijuana all the time.
Right.
So they create a dependence on that. Why aren't they then progressing to heroin? Well, it probably has something to do with, the number one, the brain chemistry. It's like I said, you don't inherit, there's no genetic, you know, a gene. There's not an addictive gene. But you do inherit, either an imbalanced or sensitive nervous system that makes taking drugs like self-medicating. It makes you feel better. It makes you feel more normal. Okay, so it might be that marijuana addresses the need for that person who's dependent on it, whatever their brain chemistry is, and a different drug will help someone else better address it. But I think there's also a risk-taking factor here. Like some people would be afraid to try something like, say, speed or heroin, or some people wouldn't. And then, but those other drugs are so addictive that all you have to do is use them once or twice and you can become addicted pretty quickly. So.
Right. And I think that people know they can become addicted quickly and yet still they do it.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. It's denial, I guess.
I think when we were younger, we didn't understand it as well. But I think that today, in view of everything we see, you know, nothing's a secret anymore. And you certainly see it all over the place. But, you know, there's warnings that you learn. In fact, my daughter used to be in that group DARE when she was in school. You know, people against drug abuse and making posters and winning awards for it. And obviously she didn't make that connection when she started using drugs, but it wasn't like she wasn't aware of it. And plus my brother died from drugs right in my house. You know, he lived with me the last 3 years he was alive. So she was certainly exposed to the damage that it did to our whole family. And yet it didn't seem to equate in her own mind.
Well, you know, the DARE program was found to be have zero effectiveness. Because once kids get to be teenagers, they start to become influenced not by the adults or anyone else in their life, but by their peers. So if their peers are using it, and somebody hands something to them, and that person is fine. They're not in jail. They're not doing all these things that they said would happen to them in the DARE program or that their parents taught them. So why can't I? You know, so that's why I think that no matter what you know, it's not going to change it. The heroin use has gone up, like between 1990 and 1996, it increased among teens 100%, and ever since then it's been rising several percent per year. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse because it's easily accessible. It's everywhere, and now it's more potent so that they can get the same effect without using needles. So it's really insidious, and the prescription drug use is now the third most abused drug after alcohol and marijuana. So that's even worse. That's an even worse problem.
And I think alcohol is probably much easier to get, right?
Yeah.
Alcohol is probably easier to get than drugs, but I don't know. There's so many people using drugs, I guess they're probably not that hard to get when you go into somebody's house and start looking around, you know, with prescription drugs.
Yeah,
so
they are everywhere.
Now, with other kinds of drugs, is there a better recovery rate than heroin?
Yes.
Let's say cocaine or crack or...
Yeah, well, crack
Oxycontin.
But there's something about, you know, some of the, like the cocaine, well, speed is pretty, can kill you, you know, if you use it not for very long. Those drugs, the stimulants, are so hard on the body that there seems almost an expiration date to them. What I've observed, people will use them for a few years, usually. Occasionally it's longer, but the most common thing is like just for a few years and then they stop. I'm not sure what that is, but
mm-hmm.
that can happen.
Well, you know, once again, whether it's drug addiction, smoking, which is a very hard habit to quit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say smoking is the hardest one to quit, although I don't necessarily believe that because I am a former smoker and I was able to quit. Food will always be a lifetime challenge to me, so I don't know about
mm-hmm.
that either. But I think
that's
any addiction,
one.
Yeah, any addiction that stops your life from going in a smooth way. But I do feel that, you know, people can survive with food addictions or to a degree smoking and still be accountable for themselves. But I think with drugs, it's a whole other story, and alcohol too.
Yeah, for sure.
And with sexual addiction, I'm really surprised to hear you say that the number of people who recover is so high, because I was under the impression from the people I've spoken with, you know, who have sexual addictions, they're really not looking to really change them. You know,
well, you know, nobody's waiting to change any addiction until they're ready, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that is something that, you know, takes something drastic to happen, you know, a kind of bottoming out, as they say in AA,
mm-hmm.
you know, some kind of moment, an epiphany, a strong moment of honesty. That might be caused by a legal problem or the loss of a relationship or the loss of a job or home or health. Those are usually the types of things that make people wake up. Not always.
Mm-hmm.
Not always. You know.
No, that's the sad part. You know, many times people just don't wake up until
no.
it's too late. You know, they lose their life over
yeah.
an addiction. Gambling's another bad one, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people
mm-hmm.
lose their homes over gambling addictions, you know, and they're obsessed. I'll never forget, I went one night to the casino with someone who had a terrible gambling addiction, but I didn't know that then. I was really naive about gambling addictions. I hadn't run into it. And I said to him, I'll drive you there from Philadelphia, but, you know, I have to go home by midnight. And he said, not a problem, let's just go and have fun. Well, midnight came and midnight left, and I had no choice because I just couldn't leave him there. But we didn't leave that casino until 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was so angry.
But let me
you know,
guess,
I realized
until,
what was
until
happening.
That, until it was, he was broke.
Until he had nothing left to gamble.
Right, yeah. I know, he had a lot of gamblers in my family. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm saying that's
yeah.
when I knew that was the addiction. And
yep.
I never went with him again because I knew what it was about then.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of complexities. Now, do you think your app will help people with addictions?
Well, that screen for addictions and compulsive behaviors,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody, of course, again, somebody has to be motivated. You know, there's a lot of things out there for addictions. And
mm-hmm.
what they have shown, they had this big study in the 90s and, you know, studying what makes people ready to work on an addiction. And what they found was that when a person was at the stage of readiness, anything worked, okay? therapy worked, AA worked, rehab worked. And, you know, it's like once a person reaches that bottoming out, anything works.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if somebody was serious about being clean and sober and was getting the help they needed, the app would be really good because if they get an urge, there's a screen that can take them through that urge. And if they go through that screen and answer the questions and find a resource to use in that moment, they're not going to use. So, they, you know, it's just a matter of being motivated to use the tools that are
mm-hmm.
available. So, yeah.
So, Marian, if somebody wants to get the app, how do they
mm-hmm.
get it?
Well, they have to. They can get it in the App Store or at Google Play. So, if they have a pad or a tablet or a smartphone of any type,
mm-hmm.
you know, Android or iOS, or they can get it in either one of those places. Search for Mind Warrior. The name of the app is Mind Warrior. You can find
and
in
you
your
can also
store.
Read about it on Facebook, right? Because you have the Mind Warrior app on Facebook.
Yes.
So you can go there
yes,
and read more about it and like the page,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
yes, and
where is that app store? Is it on your phone?
Yeah, do you have an iPhone?
I'm so stupid when it comes to that kind of phone thing. I have a smartphone now. I'm trying to learn how to use it. So if I
do you have an iPhone or an Android?
I don't think I have either one. I have like a Samsung Lite.
I know. Okay, but the format is either iOS or Android. So if
yeah,
it's
they
an
never
iOS,
told me.
Well, if on your apps that come with the phone, you either see an app store or an app that says Google Play.
Oh, okay.
If you have an Android phone. And then you go in there and you search and you'll find it.
Under Mind Warrior?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to go to on the app store, right?
Yep.
Okay. And once again, there is a page on it on Facebook, so you can look it up there. And it will really make a difference from the people I know who have downloaded it. They say it is such a helpful tool. And all I can say, Marianne, is I can't thank you enough for being a guest. I can't believe our hour is up already.
I know, that went so fast.
I know, there's always so many things to talk about that we don't ever have time to cover. So, of course, I will impose on you again in a couple of months if you don't mind. And
I would love
ask
to.
You to
thank
come
you.
Back. Oh, thank
Absolutely.
You. Are you still running
okay.
your support group online before we go?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, can we talk a little bit about that for a moment? Mm-hmm.
Yep. If you're in a destructive relationship with a narcissist, sociopath, or psychopath, or anyone who is deceiving you or abusing you, the website is www.destructiverelationshipshelp.com. And you'll see in the services section where you can get to the online group and when it's going to be held.
Okay, that's great. So for those people who are looking for support, you hold it every other Sunday, is that correct?
Right, at this point, it's every third Sunday.
Every third Sunday, so once a month.
It's posted on there. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you can be anywhere in the world and still come to this support meeting. And Marianne is very generous with her time to, offer to help you through this support. And many of us understand the meaning of being married to a narcissist or a sociopath. Or what's the other category?
Psychopath.
Okay. Well, there's three good areas
married,
that most of us have.
And like we discussed, being married to a gay man and being a cover for a gay man, for instance, who is deliberately using you for that purpose, it's the same dynamic and it has the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
And
many of our
women
are definitely married
support.
To narcissists. We do know that. We have big conversations about that.
I am sure.
So, absolutely, that's extra support, and I will post it on, to our people also to remind them that you're doing this. So, Marianne, thank you so much, and I'll be talking to you soon again.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks for all of your
the
help
pleasure.
For all of our women all of the time. All right, everybody, have a good week, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye, Marianne. Thank you. Love you.
Love you.